Thanks, Eileen. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody, on this Thursday afternoon. 51551, ray@rte.ie. And I get a sense that we all want to talk about Sinead O'Connor. Poor, beautiful Sinead. So we're going to keep the conversation going. I bumped into Christy Moore on the way in. I actually gave him my car parking space. But we were talking about Sinead, and he had done a number of duets with her. And we both agreed that she was a contradiction. You know, she was quiet, but she could be loud. She was very vulnerable, but yet armor strong on many occasions. She was fragile, but fearless. She was definitely true to herself in music and true to the causes she believed in, always. She was troubled and tortured, and I hope that wherever she is found peace. And the voice, the voice, like words fail you, really, sort of otherworldly, mesmerising, beautiful, powerful, angry, sometimes almost violent. And there's been a wonderful outpouring of affection for Sinead O'Connor. We loved her, and we'll talk more about her, but I suppose first let's hear some of that amazing, powerful, beautiful Sinead O'Connor music. Sinead.
This is the last day of our acquaintance. Oh, I don't wanna be no man's woman. It don't make me happy, this man trolling thing that you got for me. So I become
Of that song on the Late Late Show finishes up the brilliant documentary Nothing Compares. I rewatched it last night, and it explains Sinead O'Connor in her words and in people who knew her words. And one of the people who's in that is Paul Byrne. He was in with us last week, the drummer in Tuonua, and he knew Sinead O'Connor when she was 15. How are you doing, Paul?
Hey, Ray.
Yeah.
Seen bad days.
Yeah, yeah, very sad. It's just that she was so fragile and so talented, and she never, I think, realised how much she had going for herself. When she was 15 and her life was in front of her, you met her. What were the details of it?
You probably know that she was in on Greenall, and after she had been caught shoplifting, she was in a place up in Cabra or Drumcondra, and my sister Jeanette was doing psychology, and she was doing work experience there, looking after the girls in the evening, giving the nuns a break, you know.
Mm.
And Jeanette, being a singer, got them into playing music and got the nuns to buy them loads of guitars, and quickly discovered that Sinead was a great guitarist or a great, great singer, and got her, took her to Goodwin's, got her a really good guitar. And then when Jeanette was getting married, she had the girls at her choir, you know. And at the rehearsal for the wedding, Sinead sang Evergreen, a solo, she had a solo spot. And I just went, who is this singer? You know, it was just chilling. It was incredible. And couldn't believe that a kid, you know, this size and this age, because you're tiny, you know. So In Tuonua was in its sort of early days. We were a bunch of musicians experimenting. Our guitarist, Ivan O'Shea, was the sound engineer in Eamon Andrews' studio. So we had weekends. We used to go in there and experiment and put stuff down and make tracks, you know. And so we had two tracks going. We had no singer. So Ivan gave one to Leslie, and then the other one was a track Martin had written, Martin Clancy. And I happened to have a tape in my pocket at the wedding and the wedding rehearsal. And I grabbed it outside and I said, look, would you be interested in doing some work with us? So she said she'd love to. So myself and Martin went up to meet her the next night in the family common room space up in the home, and we played at the track. And she said, "Oh, I mean, I've got my mock leaving cert. I'm a mock junior cert tomorrow in French, so it might be a few days before I get back to you." And she rang me the next day to say that she had written the lyrics. So we went up that night. She sang it over the Ghetto Blaster, and it was a fully formed song, "Don't Call Take My Hand," which we went on to record later with Leslie for Island Records, with produced ironically by Steve Cooley, who eventually married Sinead. But
and Paul, just explain to people what On Green On was.
On Green On was, well, you don't really want to talk to Jeanette about that, but it seemed to be just a place for a refuge for girls who were troubled.
Mm.
A lot of the girls had been through huge trauma, you know, and it was just a refuge, I think, you know. Mm. They seemed to be very kind there, and I certainly got a sense that the girls were all very well looked after, you know.
Yeah. So she was too young to join in Tuonua, and Leslie got the job. But she left her mark, Sinead O'Connor, on in Tuonua by writing the lyrics for your first single.
Absolutely. I mean, we hung out for a while, you know. We went in Damon Andrews' studios and we did a quick demo of it, I think, on a weekend, and then we were going to do a proper recording of it in Westland Studios with Jerry Leonard engineering. Jerry, who went on to become Bowie's guitarist. And it was a Wednesday afternoon. Well, the only time she could be free was she had a half day from school on a Wednesday. She was allowed to go out to school outside the convent, you know, up the road. And basically she said, "I have a 3-hour window between 1 o'clock and 4 o'clock where the nuns won't notice that I'm missing." So I had to borrow my friend's car, run up, collect her, bring her into the studio in town, get the vocals down, and get her back before the nuns noticed she was missing. You can actually, that recording is actually up on SoundCloud.
Oh, is it? Right. A 15-year-old Sinead O'Connor singing with Tuonua.
Singing Take My Hand,
And then she went on, she was the lead singer in Ton Ton Macoute, and then she went solo.
So we kept in touch. We felt terrible, you know. Like Sinead would come and she'd find out where we were having a drink and she would turn up and she'd turn up at Damon Andrews Studios. She really, really wanted to be in the band, you know, but we're going, "Sinead, you know, you're 15, you're going," she was about to go to boarding school.
Mm.
And we were all at the point, we were all 21, we were giving up college. Two of us, myself and Leslie, were giving up college to really go for it, you know, and it was just, you know, what wasn't a good fit, you know, perfect fit. And,
So we actually found that, Paul. Sorry, I didn't know. A lot going on today. So we have that here from SoundCloud. Take My Hand. So this is Sinead O'Connor. 15, you say, Paul. And Take My Hand.
Yeah.
What was it about her voice, Paul? What made it so special and otherworldly?
Well, I'd never heard a voice like it. The purity, I suppose, was one of the things, you know. Like, she sang at the wedding, she was singing a Barbra Streisand song, and I couldn't stand Barbra Streisand, but she made me sit up and listen to her version of that song,
you
know.
Yeah,
yeah. And I think she went on to do that, didn't she? You know, just... It didn't matter what genre she sang in. Like, her version of She Moved Through the Fair is, to me, the definitive one now.
And then she had a big band album as well. She could do anything, really, couldn't she?
She could do anything and reggae, you know. Really could do anything.
Yeah.
Her Don't Cry For Me Argentina is a classic.
That's from that album, her third album. Paul, go on.
No, I was going to say, we went off, signed our deal. She went to school, and then... we ended up rehearsing in the Temple Lane rehearsal studios. You know, the record company hired the place for us for a month to go in. And lo and behold, who's in the next room but Sinead with Tom McCoot.
There you go. She'll be sadly missed. Paul Byrne from Drummer with Intuinua. Thanks, Paul. Mind yourself. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye, bye, bye. Now, 5 on 5, 5 on RedRTE.ie. To place Sinead in her proper place in the pantheon of great vocalists, compare her version of Nothing Compares to You to Prince's anemic version. And Prince is recognised as a great vocalist. There's no comparison. As in, it doesn't compare, yes. R.I.P., lovely girl. And I saw Sinead perform live in Vicar Street in 2015, touring the album I'm Not Bossy, I'm the Boss. She sang a couple of songs a cappella during the gig. To see and hear her perform live in front of you, you understand immediately why she was a very special talent, a powerful voice and performer, a terrible loss, Gavin in a Thigh. There's an a cappella version of I Am Stretched Across Your Grave. I couldn't find it last night when I went looking for it, but I found it years ago. I think it was recorded on some Icelandic radio station. It's just out of this world. And Con's been on, says, as a person who's a survivor of the mother and baby home in Ross Cray, thank you, Sinead. Nothing compares to you. We watched you singing on stage, singing Mother with Roger Waters on stage. As we watched it over and over again, we knew it was coming from the gut. Then we watched you in the film The Butcher Boy by Neil Jordan, Sinead as the Virgin Mary. We will never forget the song. You made me a piece of your heart from the film Some Mother Son by Jim Sheridan. Rest in power, warrior woman sister. Condolences to family and friends, says Con. And Mel has been on from Lithuania. He says, Ray, I'll forever remember Sinead O'Connor with this story. I was working part-time in 1992 in a diner on Georgia Street in Dublin. One wet Tuesday evening, as I was stacking the chairs and wiping the tables down, who comes knocking on the door but Sinead and a friend? Naturally, I knew who she was, and she asked could they come in for a drink. When leaving, Sinead said she had no cash to leave a tip, so I asked her to sing a song instead. She duly obliged by singing the full version of Scarlet Ribbons. It was the best tip I ever received. Oh, and can I add that 1 month later, she dropped by, asked for me by name, and gave me 50 Irish punts as a tip. In 1992, that was like £200 or €200 now. After that, every time she met me around the streets of Dublin, she would stop and chat with me, as she knew I had a big interest in music. She was beautiful inside and out. That's the thing, isn't it? Safe journey to your next station in the cosmos. Nothing will ever compare to you, Sinead, says Mel. Damien Dempsey, who worked with Sinead a lot, has released a statement. And I remember we had Damien in the theatre in Bewley's on Grafton Street one afternoon, maybe it was 11 to 12 back in the day, and Sinead was doing backing vocals, and she was happy to do that and let Damien shine as he did. And then she used to do a lot of work with Barrettstown. I remember emceeing a gig in Vicar Street and Sinead sang three or four songs. And she did tireless work for causes that you wouldn't know about. I remember when we were doing a lot of talking about mental health 10, 12 years ago, Sinead rang me out of the blue and said she was going into the Dáil to meet the minister responsible for our mental health services, and she wondered would I be able to go with her, and I couldn't go at the time. But she was going in to represent people who hadn't got voices, because she knew that she had a voice and the people would take her call. And that's the type of person she was. Damien, this is Damien Dempsey's statement. The warrior queen has passed across the great divide, my friends, to be with her son and mammy. No one on earth could sing like her, in my humble opinion. I had the incredible honour of sharing the stage and studio with the head chief many times. And she brought me on tour, where I sat at her feet every night and watched in awe as she waked the dead and soared like an eagle, singing our ancestors alive and fighting the eternal fight of good against evil. An incredible force of nature soaring in sublime song and helping people through life with her bejeweled poetry. Universal Mother, that she recorded with my brother John Reynolds, is one of the greatest albums ever recorded, I reckon. She was an unbelievable bard. Her poetry, like her voice, transported people somewhere, hoisted you up on the eagle's back, and off you went. When I toured with her on the Shan Noa's Nua tour, she was such great fun and in a really good place, with a filthy sense of humour and a really strong vibration. And after most every show, we'd find a nearby pub or dressing room and have a sing-song. I remember after one particular show in Waterford, lots of Sinead's cousins showed up and claimed she got her voice from their side of the family. And when we had the sing-song in Tramore that night, I have to say there were great chanters and great crack like Sinead. She had the soul of a punk, fearless in what she believed in, and wielded her art like a sword to cut at the psychopaths of the earth. And I believe she's happy now to be with two people she really missed who were taken too soon, her mammy and her son. Thank you, Sinead, for your brave, wonderful example of how to stand up to the powers that be and give others the strength to do the same. The good you've done is rippling across the earth and always will. A great legacy you can be fiercely proud of. And he finishes up by saying, may the great spirit hold you in the hollow of her hand, sister. Gra mór agus meas mór, Damo. That's Damien Dempsey there, remembering the late Sinead O'Connor. Spectacularly brilliant. Sinead O'Connor from 1987, from The Lion, the Cobra. She was 21 and that was her debut album. That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. A lot of people are mentioning Sinead's version of The Foggy Jew. Have we got that somewhere there? I can't see it there, so we'll get that for you later on. Sinead did a great version of Foggy Jew with the Chieftains, and Sinead's version of the Foggy Jew makes the hair stand on the back of my neck. Brilliant. She could sing any song and make it her own. R.I.P. Sinead, Paddy in Castle Dermot. And I remember at the height of the COVID, this is John A. in Killarney, we were asked to light a candle as a show of solidarity during this tough time. And Sinead sung a version of Light Up by Snow Patrol. It had everyone in tears throughout the country. May she rest in peace. That's John A. in Killarney. And yeah, a bit of Foggy Jew there. This is Sinead with the Chieftains. Now, RTE have just announced that on Saturday night coming, they're broadcasting Sinead O'Connor live at Vicar Street. It'll be broadcast on RTE1 television. The hour-long special recorded live in Vicar Street in 2002. She was joined by her remarkable band for the inspirational and uplifting performance. And the songs included on the set list on that night, Molly Malone, My Laggin' Love, Nothing Compares to You, and Fire on Babylon. So they're 11:15 this Saturday night, live at Vicar Street, Sinead O'Connor. And keep those memories of Sinead coming in. And if you just want to comment on what an amazing human being she was and what a brilliant singer she was, or if you met her over the years, 51551 or ray@rte.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we will come back to memories of Sinead O'Connor, and we have a musical tribute before the end of the programme as well from Shobzy. And we have to do the quiz as well, so we're looking for two of you to come on after 4 o'clock and take part in our daily quiz. And the prize this week is a two-night stay in the Hendrick in Smithfield, which is there in Dublin 7, just off Smithfield Square. A great location to go and explore everything the Dublin City has to offer. HendrickDublin.ie, HendrickDublin.ie. It's a good prize. Here's your qualifying question today. Who scored Ireland's only goal in yesterday's World Cup game against Canada? Was it Katie McCabe or Katie Taylor? Who scored Ireland's only goal in yesterday's World Cup game against Canada? Was it Katie McCabe or Katie Taylor? 0818715925. 0818715925. Now, I've been reading this book over the last few days, Cracking the Case, Inside the Mind of a Top Garda. It's the new book by retired Chief Superintendent Christy Mangan. It's a biography of Christy's career, which spanned 40 years and saw him deal with the toughest of crimes, including some of the biggest murder cases Ireland has had. He's the most senior Garda to ever write about his career, and it truly is a thrilling, insightful, harrowing And it sort of just gives us a window into a world that very few of us would have a window into. Yesterday, 26th of July, marked 41 years to the day that he first stepped foot into Templemore Garda College, and he joins me now in Studio 7. How are you doing, Christy?
Good, Ray, thank you.
Did you realise yesterday was your 26th anniversary?
I did realise. I still remember it when you walk through the gates. It certainly leaves an indelible mark on you when you walk through those gates. You'll always remember it, and every Garda will remember the day they walked through those gates, yes.
1982,
yeah.
Ireland was a different place, and I suppose how society looked on members of an Garda Síochána Síochána was quite different as well, wasn't it?
Yes, it has changed, I suppose, from the 60s, 70s, right through the 80s. There has been probably a change, but I still think the guards have a huge part to play within the communities. They are relatively still well embedded through the GAA, through coaching, through a lot of other activities. So it has changed, and I suppose people's attitudes have changed. You know, some people would say maybe it's more violent now, but I would have been in the serious crime review team, and we would have reviewed crimes that were committed in the 70s, and unfortunately we were pretty violent to ourselves back in the 60s and 70s as well, but yeah, people don't have memories of it.
We'll get to that that review team that you were heading up, because there's a lot of talk at the moment, isn't there, about you know, staffing in an Garda Síochána, difficulty in recruiting new guards. Why do you think that is?
Well, there is huge commentary there in relation to the staffing and the retention of staff. And I would have seen that myself when I was serving. There's a number of, I suppose, points to be discussed. Number one, it's difficult for people to decide to go down to Templemore for €184 a week.
That's what they get, isn't it?
That's what they're getting. And that's very, very poor. So put yourself in the position of a young guard, or a young person who's making a decision they're going to join the guards, and maybe they have a mortgage, they have a family, or they have commitments or whatever. And then to go down to Templemore, it's intensive training.
And do you have to pay for accommodation out of that,
no,
Christy?
No, you don't. You don't have to pay for food or accommodation,
right.
But you still have to pay your mortgage or whatever bills you have,
yes,
or
yeah,
your loan for your car or whatever.
So that needs to be looked at.
It needs to be hugely looked at, yeah.
And the other thing that were mentioned was the retirement age. So you retired at 60.
Is that mandatory? That was compulsory,
right,
that I would retire. I literally retired on my 60th birthday. You close the door, you walk out, and it's as blunt and as blank as that.
And some people were saying they should stretch that age to maybe 62, because some people at that age have still a lot to offer, and they want to offer it.
Yes, and there are a considerable number of guards who would have a lot to offer. It just depends on what stage people are in their lives. But they have huge corporate knowledge, they have huge knowledge of the community, they have contacts within the community, they've built up a lot of relationships there. And to literally walk out, close the door, and you're not downloaded, nobody downloads you for all that information.
No.
Nobody gets a USB key and inserts it and says, listen, tell me what you know.
It seems like a big waste of corporate knowledge.
It's an enormous amount of corporate knowledge left behind, and that's right from the guard who's on the beat, the guard who's in the community policing section, detectives, right up to chief superintendent, all the ranks. It goes with you.
Well, let's go back right to the start. Why did you join the guards? Was there a history of it in the family?
No, absolutely no history in our family. My father had a garden nursery with my mum, mother, Claire and Oliver. They ran for a number of years. I would have worked in that. That was probably a big interest for me, was gardening and flowers and plants and so on and so forth. But I suppose an influence on me, Dunshaughlin, if anybody knows it, the old Garda barracks was on the right hand side as you come in from Dublin, and handball was a big game there, so I would have went up there, and the guards were always seemed to be pretty good at it, but it was the wall was at the back of it,
right.
But I suppose the local sergeant Seamus McGee was an imposing figure, and I would have played a number of games against him, and he was a very, very powerful character, but a very good man. You listened to him when he spoke to you, and if he told people to go home, they went home. But you know, then there's a number of other things. I suppose I would have worked in an undertaker's in Dunshaughlin too. So Look, it's a difficult profession. Well, I would have found it difficult. You know, you were making coffins and then digging graves, and you would have seen probably a different side to life with people, how they mourn and the tragedies maybe of, you know, traffic collisions, and look, people will die of old age. So, there's, you know, you see all that. And then, look, I went to St. Pat's in Navan, you know, a very, very good school. It'll straighten you out for sure, St. Pat's. I enjoyed my time down there. I suppose more than a number of us at the time, we decided we'd take a day off or two. And Navan is known as the Bounce. Other places probably known as Mitchin, and so on and so forth. I shouldn't have been Mitchin anyway. But anyway, myself and another colleague, as well as his friend at the time, we decided we'd go Mitchin, and this place called the Ramparts in Navan, and we were down there. We thought we were great. And having a cigarette and probably freezing cold as well. But anyway, we were walking along and he lost his footing and fell into the river. He was an excellent swimmer, very, very good swimmer. And we pulled him out eventually anyway, but sure, he was drowned wet. So struck on a great plan. I would go up to his house and get a set of clothes for him and bring them back and things would be grand. But when I went up to Navan Town, up Trimgate Street, not a lot of traffic around the place. Got the set of clothes, I'm grand, no problem whatsoever. Coming back down, I could see a lot of very heavily armed men that had taken over Navan and they were robbing the local bank. So I was looking on with great interest, and as I'm looking on with great interest, one of the raiders, balaclava, military style, clothing.
Yeah.
And he's staring at you and you're kind of wondering what's going on here and, you know, what'll I do? And I was tall enough, young fella, I suppose, too. But he kept the gun trained in me, and you know.
Oh, he pointed a gun at you.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, sure. He was literally only maybe 6 or 8 feet away, very close. And
did he say anything to you?
Well, there was a load of shouting going on.
All right,
it was absolute mayhem. Everybody was running everywhere, and look, I was just there on the footpath, say, you know, probably not I was taking it all in, and I would have said later on it was kind of like a movie, but it was a real life movie. But I spotted in the corner of my eye my sister across the road, and she was in her school uniform, but I didn't find out later, but she had been down there legitimately doing a message for the school teacher. So anyway, the raid took place and they took off, and to be fair, the guards took off after them, and there was a shootout, and the Sergeant Keyes, who's mentioned, was shots fired at him. So he was awarded a Scott Medal later on, but look at I was glad to get out of the place and go down and rescue me.
So you're impressed by the sergeant that you played handball with. You encountered death, I suppose, younger than most people would on a regular basis in the Undertakers.
Yeah.
And then you happened upon this scene. So those three things contributed to you making a decision to go into the Guards. Your first posting was in Sundrive, was it?
Sundrive Road, which when I heard it was going to Sundrive Road, somebody from Dublin told me that was on the border. And I was looking at maps, trying to figure out, obviously we had no Google and so on and so forth at the time, trying to figure out where this place was on the border. But as somebody told me then eventually, that's in Crumlin.
Yeah.
So I would have had to live in Crumlin for a while because I had no car at the time and so on and so forth. So that was my first posting. And I would say an amazing posting because very busy area, very, very close to Dolphin's Barn, which was probably, you know, it's unfortunate, but it was a supermarket for any drug you wanted.
And there was a heroin epidemic, wasn't there, in the 80s?
Yeah, a terrible heroin epidemic swept across Dublin in particular.
So that was a tough introduction to the real world for you. I suppose you'd led a sort of a cosseted enough. Had you?
Well, I'm from the country. A small village.
And there was no drugs in the 80s Dublin. They might probably in the other big cities, but towns, in the main.
In the main, you wouldn't have seen drugs. You wouldn't have seen people injecting heroin. Yeah. You wouldn't have seen any of that. You certainly didn't see the violence that resulted from people. And it is a vicious circle because you have people taking drugs, then they need money so they go out and commit robberies. Mm. Then we would have been coming across them coming out of banks, building societies after committing robberies. And obviously their intent, hell-bent on getting away in their stolen car, and you have a basic 2-foot wooden batten. which you wouldn't do a lot anyway, but you know, you're trying to catch them. And it's, look, it's youth, you know, youth and exuberance and so on and so forth, and you think there's no tomorrow.
Naivety, yeah. You think you're invincible, I suppose.
I'd say more you think you're invincible than naive, because you always realise that, you know, a bullet could come and right. And you're gone.
Was that something that you lived with every day?
Well, in the 80s in particular, look, when you were out with your partner in the patrol car, yeah. or you were in the detective car, you were quite prepared for this is going to happen, because it was a very violent time and armed robberies were being committed on a daily basis. People, you know, would decide to rob a bank and they would get a large metal object, come in, smash down the glass and then rob the bank, jump over the counter, as jump overs they were called too, and out and into a stolen car and gone, and then the proceeds to head back to whatever.
And did you ever come upon one?
Oh, yes, many, many times. I suppose one of the first times I came across it was 1988. It was Christmas Eve, actually. Look, at no more than anybody else, I had to go into work. I was working 2 to 10. I was looking forward to the next day, Christmas
and
Day.
There was a Christmas card you had to get for your wife.
Oh, that's right. I actually had my wife had said to me she likes cards, so for her, she said to me, make sure you get the Christmas card and so on and so forth. So I went up to the Crumlin Shopping Centre. To just see if I could get a Christmas card, but it was full, absolutely full. You couldn't get into it, so I said, right, there's a little shop up in Galtymore Road in Drimna, I'll nip up there and I'll get it. I was driving the patrol car, an automatic and so on and so forth. So I, on the way up, we were told by the Garda Control that an armed robbery had taken place in Drimna, in Walkinstown, and that they were gone across towards the Long Mile Road, which interlinks then with Drimna. So we were on our way up, you know, okay, we'll be up that way anyway and I'll still get the card as well. So they gave a very good description of the car, and there's three raiders in it and the two of them were armed and so on and so forth. So as we were pulling up towards the shop, Mick Minogue, a Clare man, was with me, a good Clare hurler. Mick was with me, and Mick, we saw the stolen car and the driver had his head down looking out through the steering wheel trying to conceal himself. So Mick got out of the passenger side. I jammed in the stolen car, put the patrol car in park so that he wouldn't be able to push, and he was spinning the wheels trying to push me out. A lot of smoke coming from the rear tyres of the stolen car. Mick went round the back of the car and then the driver reversed the car over him. I thought to myself, that's Mick dead. And then I'm with my baton, I'm trying to smash the window off the stolen car. Timber will not break. I needed metal, obviously. So as this is going on, the two raiders come out and they've guns, and they're screaming and roaring as not to move. Thankfully, Mick was struggling to get up off the ground, and I suppose it's what you do. Your natural reaction. He's screaming and roaring at you not to move, and then you deal with him forcibly. You have to.
What did you do?
I had to hit him. That's it. He was going to kill me. He was shouting, get away, I'll shoot you. There was a lot of people around the place. And Mick and myself then disarmed him. And then the stolen car did a nice bit of damage to my patrol car, which I was kind of very concerned about because I was only driving the car a week. And you get in trouble for
damage, do you?
Oh, you would. You get in a lot of trouble for...
There's a sort of dark sense of humour in the Gardaí as well, obviously.
There is. But look, it worked out. The guy, we arrested him, he was charged. He actually people mightn't think this, but he actually was a nice guy.
Oh, here's the thing. Yeah. Right, this is what I want to talk to you about, Christy, because how many murder cases have you covered in your career?
It is in excess of 100.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
I've been around a long time.
Yeah. So you've spoken to an awful lot of murderers in your time.
I have.
Like most people wouldn't encounter a murderer in a lifetime.
No, and they're lucky. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's a humanity about your approach.
Yeah, but you have to. I think you have to have a humanity with people when you're dealing with so many people, because people find themselves in difficult circumstances. And I always try and explain to guards in particular, because look, for the last 40 years, I've been dealing with a lot of guards. But you have to understand that if a serious crime takes place, and look, murder is the most serious of all crimes, and the family of the victim suffer badly. They really, really do. A terrible tragedy has taken place, and forevermore, they're never going to be in the happy place they were in prior to this. But the suspect's family, the offender's family, or whatever we would call them, and eventually they're convicted, that family also suffers a sentence, because the mum and dad are invariably very, very decent people. This, they never expected it would happen. And then they have to live their lives. And I would have got a huge understanding from speaking to suspects' families in particular, because you need to get an understanding of where the murderer came from, who they were, why did they end up like this, how did it happen. Now, look, some of them are just plain bad. They're bad people.
Would you say that's the minority of murders? Because I'm intrigued about evil, you know.
Yeah.
Are some people that you encounter just evil?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, so some people are, and a number of them, and thankfully I couldn't say it was a huge amount, but certainly you would say there's certain people when you catch them in the eye, you'd say, right, well, I know that you will try and kill me. I know that you're going to try and kill me, so I will deal with you appropriately. Now, you'll always be on your guard when you're dealing with somebody, particularly violent people and so on and so forth. But there's certain people you'd say, right, you're to the bone evil.
Okay, so the other group of people, have they got anything in common? You say in the book, which I'm fascinated by as well, that we're all capable of committing murder. Now, I don't know if I agree with you.
I think I said most.
Oh, you said most of us, right. Most of us.
Well, I do think most of us, and actually somebody said it to me yesterday, they were with a very small child, a two-year-old child, and somebody said to me, I don't think you're right there, Christy. And I said, well, okay, I put the scenario to you, that beautiful two-year-old is there with you, and that person is coming through a door and they have a knife or a gun. What would you do to protect that child? You would do your utmost to protect the child. Well, I certainly would. And, you know, if somebody has been tackled in a certain, a given a set of circumstances, I think, look, it's just a fight or flight.
Okay.
And I invariably would have been involved in the fight. But, you know, most people, I think...
So self-defence.
Yeah.
When you put that caveat in, I agree with you. Yes. To protect our loved ones.
Protect your loved ones, maybe to protect your house.
Yes.
Maybe to protect whatever else. So, you know...
Now I was saying at the outset that you've been across some of the most famous murder cases in the history of the state. Farah Swala Noor.
Yes.
And his remains were found in the canal. He had been sawn up, cut up, and put in a carrier bag or a suitcase and placed in the canal. And the crime was committed in flat 170 in Richmond Cottages, Ballybock. Where were you when you got the call about that find, the find in the canal?
That find, I was getting ready to go out. There's a small place called Batterstown, it's in County Mead. Anybody who knows this, it's on the way to Trim, beautiful place. And I was coaching a Camogie team, Black Isle Gael's Camogie team. Fantastic set of girls that are involved down there. So I was getting ready to go out and train the team because we had a championship match coming up. I literally had put on tracksuit, the usual, what all coaches wear. So I go out onto the pitch and getting the drills ready and so on and so forth. So I obviously have my phone with me because you're on call all the time. I was the detective inspector in Fitzgibbon Street at the time. So I'm getting a phone call from Colin Fox. Colin, unfortunately, is deceased recently. So Colin is ringing me and Colin is saying, that there's body parts in the canal. And look at Ibis, you know, saying, we've often seen it before where, you know, people would dress up dummies and throw them in and so on and so forth. And it's happened on a number of occasions. So I kind of said to Colin, look, sure, you know, do you need me to go in and what do you want? And look, I was the senior investigating officer if it was a murder case. So I said, right, would you mind asking one of the fire crew that were there, will they just jump into the canal and see what they find? So Colin is on the phone, he has it open and I'm listening and he's talking to the fire crew, who were brilliant actually, and they used a fire drag rake, and next thing Colin says, yeah, this is a body part, Christy, you better come in. Or he would have called me Kig at the time, that's what we were called.
Kigra.
Kigra, yeah.
Kigra.
Yeah,
so that was the beginning of that case for you.
And we're
hold that thought, I'm going to take a commercial break and we'll talk more to Christy Mangan about his new book, Cracking the Case, Inside the Mind of a Top Garda, after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Tweet at Radio Ray RTE, The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now we're speaking to Christy Mangan. His new book is called Cracking the Case, Inside the Mind of a Top Garda. So we're going to continue talking about the case of the murder of Farah Suala Noor after Nocht. We've a minute to go. So writing this book, Christy, because I did mention that you're the first retired senior Garda to do such a thing. Did you have to think about it a lot? Did you have to seek counsel, advice?
I had a lot of soul searching myself, yeah. Because look at the, you know, there's a lot of, I suppose, confidences that you didn't want to breach. You don't want to breach. And then yes, I did seek advice from people that I would have highly respected. I would have spoken to Barry Cummins. You know, Barry, yeah, has written a number of books, and other journalists and authors. And I suppose their message to me, well, you have a story to tell, and you know, and it has a lot of facts. It's a very factual based story. You've been involved in a lot of serious criminal investigations, and what they were telling me was that the public may be interested in knowing what goes on in an investigation team.
Yeah. And your relationship, and we're going to talk more about this, but your relationship, the relationship you struck up with Linda Mulhall, for example, who was one of the people who murdered Farah Suala Noor, or was it manslaughter on her?
Manslaughter, yeah.
Yes. It was her sister who
her
was
sister,
the,
Charlotte,
murder,
yeah.
And that's important to get that.
It is very important,
right.
Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
So we're going to talk to Christy Moore, but Anish Toshi now, and the Priestskelton and Nogtala, Kieran Afarda. Gramaga Kieran, Christy Mangan is with us, retired chief superintendent. Cracking the Case is his new book. So you were the senior investigating officer.
Yes, I was in charge of the...
On the murder of Farah Suala Noor.
Yes.
So you got the call. It was found in the canal. The body was found in the canal. It wasn't all the body.
No, it wasn't all the body. There was a number of body parts missing. Mainly the head was missing, which obviously was very important for identification purposes. So... We set up our murder investigation team. Next day, very, very busy day, because it's right in Ballybock Bridge. We had, you know, the night before we had young people throwing coins in, trying to spit on the remains, and then we had to close down the bridge, which wasn't a very popular decision because it's a main artery into Dublin. And then set about your technical examination, trying to establish who the deceased was, which, yeah, proved very, very problematic because we couldn't find any record of him.
This is fascinating. People will be fascinated by the science behind this,
yeah,
because it's isotope research.
Isotope research, yeah.
So there's a guy in Belfast. He, yeah, said to you, I want samples of water from all the various Garda stations.
Garda stations in Dublin.
And by getting those samples, yeah, he could tell you where that man had lived.
Yeah, he could tell us. He was able to give us a broad range of, I think it was up to 6 months, that he would have lived in the Ballybock area, which was significant when we had nothing as regards identifying this person. So we knew then that they had frequented the Ballybock area at least for that period of time. And then it obviously... We were able to concentrate a lot of our efforts in the Ballybock area, doing our media appeals, and the media, obviously, in this case, was hugely, hugely important.
Because the goriness of it, but there was a nearly a perverse interest in it, wasn't there?
Initially there was a difficulty in that, you know, the story that would have been in the media, that it was a voodoo killing, and I would have carried out a lot of research in relation to voodoo killings, and including the Boy Adam case in London, tragic case. And we would have contacted the ritual killings unit in South Africa. I would have spoken with a priest who had a huge amount of experience in dealing with... he worked in Africa.
The missions, yeah.
Yeah, he worked over there. He was a brilliant guy. And I would have sat down with him, and obviously with the ritual killings unit, and explained to what we had. And unfortunately, they were leaning towards that we had a ritual killing, which wasn't something I wanted to hear, because it was going to be very difficult. Maybe the people who were involved had gone, and they had taken the body parts that they needed, and, you know, how do you follow the evidence there? But we did a number of appeals, and eventually then we got the Ireland away white jersey was very, very important. And we got a big response when we went out with the jersey, and we got a number of people came and said, listen, I think I know who that person is. And then one person in particular told us that they had seen Farah on down in O'Connell Street, and he had been with Kathleen and the two girls.
So Kathleen Mulhall and yeah. Linda and Charlotte.
Linda and Charlotte, yeah. So that set us off on that trail.
Now, we're not going to go into details, but there are details in the book.
Yes.
The sisters were found guilty of manslaughter and murder, and the mother was found guilty of interfering with the course of justice, whatever the technical term for that is. But you, I suppose, got a confession from Linda.
Yes. Yeah.
And one of the things she said to you, you asked her, why did she confess? And she said, because you were nice to me.
Yeah. I would have, throughout the time we were, I think sometimes people think a murder investigation takes place and is over within a couple of weeks. It's not. I think this murder investigation took over 4 years to complete from the day the call came in to the final court case. So a murder investigation takes an enormous amount of time to get to completion.
And work.
And at some stages in this investigation, we had in excess of 100 officers, 100 detectives working on this case.
Is that house to house?
House to house. CCTV in this case in particular.
Is that a huge part of
it? Oh, huge, huge. We had to take, this was committed close to Croke Park, so we had to take the Croke Park CCTV system. A lot of other TV systems, but businesses in around the city centre. But to be fair, that was of benefit because when we took it, we didn't know what we were actually going to find, what we were looking for. But when we discovered who the people were involved, we were able to then track those people on the video, on the CCTV. So it takes an enormous amount of stamina and energy and resources to run a murder investigation. And you're not only doing that murder investigation. In April 2005, I was investigating four murders in total that had happened in that month. So and I'm not unique to that. It happens with other senior investigators.
What you're saying is you're stretched. You were stretched.
You were very stretched. Okay. You're very stretched. And you're dealing with all the other terrible crimes that take place, including assaults and armed robberies and very, very serious cases.
Is a confession the perfect case for you?
I would say a confession certainly is hugely beneficial, but obviously science is very important. Mm.
Did you present the science in order to get the confession? Did you go, we know that there's, for example, blood stains there, we know that this happened?
Well, we arrested Charlotte, Linda, and
Kathleen,
and the father, John. They were detained for 12 hours, and we got no evidence.
Right,
and in fact, we got no charge. It was probably a very, very deflating time for me personally, but certainly for the investigation team, because we'd put months and months of work into this and thought we had a particularly good case. But then our legal advice told us, no, you're not getting a charge of murder. And then you have to release these people. They all have to go about their own ways. And then at that time, I had been requested by my chief superintendent to move to Store Street to deal with, a number of matters there. I actually loved Fitzgibbon Street because it had the added bonus on a Sunday. I had to attend Croke Park to work.
You had to attend Croke Park. Mm.
So it was sort of a personal thing there.
Yeah.
But anyway, I then had to prepare the case for literally that was it. It had gone as far as maybe.
And that was it. Could. And you were told at that time to forget, move on.
Well, to be fair, you have to move on. You do with the cases that you have. You just can't remain with one case all the time.
So what happened after?
Well, what happened then was I was working with Sergeant Liam Hickey and myself, and we had spoken to John, and John had told
us. Dad.
The dad, yeah. He was a tough man, but he was very respectful with us. He was a strong Dublin character, very respectful to us. He had a respect for us because when he was been arrested, he was allowed to have a cigarette before he got into the patrol car.
And again, that's the humanity of it.
That struck a chord with him. So, obviously, he told us at a later stage that Linda knew where the head was and so on and so forth. So he told us, listen, you should go back up and have a talk with her. And we said, okay, we'll have to prepare for that. So we went up on a Friday and knocked at the door and spoke with Linda, and she would have been probably quite hostile to us. Now, hostile in sort of a polite way. Listen, get out, go away. I'm going to sue you. You falsely arrested me, and so on and so forth. Mm. But when she calmed down, listen, okay, have a cup of tea. And she made the tea, and look at, you know, you could see that she was under pressure, and she did nothing wrong. And I, you know, spoke at length with her, and then left the house in Kilclare and Talla, and then you're driving back towards Fitzgibbon Street with another matter to deal with over on the north side. And she rings me, and she's very emotional. She just come back, and I said okay, but I still was conscious of the fact that whatever I was going to do had to be done legally, because there's no point in going back up and taking a full statement and then ending up in the courts and the case will be thrown out. So I needed to get that right. So I had to calm, just don't rush back up, take your time, discuss it with other people, what you need to do. So I went back up, I think it was 5:15 or whatever, and went into her bedroom and took a very, very lengthy, that could have been a 20-page statement, a very lengthy detailed statement.
Do you record that or write it down?
You can't record it in the house because I didn't have the facility, but right. It's written down. So she's very emotional.
And that's transcribed in the book.
Yeah, she's very emotional. But you could see the relief in her. She was relieved to have told us what has happened, because she said that it had deeply affected her. She had a tough life, and she said it had very this act had deeply affected her, and she was basically glad to have told us. So in order to make sure that I had the case legally sound, I brought her up to Talla Garda station and I put her on audiovisual. So
and got her to do the statement again.
She recanted, or she recanted, and went through the statement again.
And that's the basis of the conviction in the end.
That's the basis of the conviction. It ended up in the courts, and yeah. Linda was convicted of manslaughter.
What about we're running out of time. I could talk to you forever, Christy, because you were the first man to do the cold cases in Ireland. So there's like the Father Malloy cases in the book as well. And then you moved up to Drogheda at a time when Drogheda was in rag order with drug violence, and you had to oversee that. And in the middle of that, then that poor Keen Mulready Woods, 17, was murdered. But the reporting of that particular, the fact that those two sisters were called what they were called, and all of that, it does take the humanity out of it, doesn't it? Like it portrays these people as animals, and you didn't find them as animals, did you?
No, they weren't. No. Well, particularly with the Mulhall case, but the Keane Mulready Woods case was different, because initially, when we were discovering that Keane had been murdered.
I'm going to stop you there, because the details are in the book, and I'm aware that we're an afternoon audience. But it a fascinating insight into the job that you did over 40 years, and I think people will be fascinated by it. And as I said, some of the most high profile murder cases that the state has witnessed in its history. Christy, enjoy your sort of half retirement.
Thank you.
And I'm sure we'll talk again.
No doubt.
I'd like to talk to you more, but we've run out of time. So cracking the case inside the mind of a top Garda Chief Superintendent, Christy Mangan. Thanks, Christy.
Thanks.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we're going to have a musical performance in honour, I suppose, of the late Sinead O'Connor before we leave you today. But we have Roisin Davies on the line. Hello, Roisin.
Hi there, Ray. How are you?
I'm sort of sad. Generally sad today.
Yeah. I think we're all sad today. I think it's fair to say that the entire country is united in our grief and our heartbreak today at the loss of Sinead. Mm. You know, I think we all feel it deeply. She was completely unique, wasn't she? There'll never be another Sinead O'Connor.
Yes, and did you feel like you wanted to mind her? The overriding
absolutely
feeling that I had towards her. Yeah, I know that's a bit patronising, but yeah.
Yes, yeah. There was a vulnerability there. I mean, I'm a year younger than her, so I mean, I grew up. She was the soundtrack to my life, as they say, in many respects. Yeah. Those years for sure, and you know, great inspiration to me, because I do a bit of singing myself, but just the way she delivered her songs, her passion in a delivery of a song was was so inspiring. You know, in college, my party piece was Black Boys on Mopeds, you know,
yeah.
And the way that she sang, I still sing it, actually, I still do. But the way that she sang and spoke, it was just from the heart, always from the beginning to the very end.
And always her,
you know?
Always her. You know,
always
that was
her.
Always true to herself, always true to herself.
Absolutely.
And I was listening to Liveline there and they were talking about the 30th anniversary Bob Dylan tribute in Madison Square Garden, and I was watching the documentary last night. So just to fill people in, Sinead O'Connor had gone on Saturday Night Live. She had sang War, which was a song by Bob Marley, which was based on a speech given by Haile Selassie, who was the emperor of Ethiopia, and it was anti-war and anti-racism. And she had done this on Saturday Night Live, a cappella, amazingly powerful. And then she ripped up a picture of the then Pope because she knew, which we all know now, but not a lot of people knew it at the time, that there was a scandal afoot, and it was child sexual abuse within the Catholic Church in Ireland. And that's the reasoning behind ripping up the picture of the Pope back then. She then went, was invited to Madison Square Garden sometime afterwards. She'd got terrible reaction in America, particularly from the evangelicals and the Christian communities because of what she did. They'd steamrolled over her CDs. Anyway, she was invited along to sing at this concert. And we're going to talk about that. Because were you there? You were there.
I was there, Ray. I was in Boston 92. I went over to my sister Aoife Clancy, who's a folk singer, and she was living in Boston at the time. So I went over to Aoife. And my dad, Bobby Clancy, was one of the... He started off with his brothers, the Clancy brothers, in the early days in Greenwich Village. So, of course, they were all, you know, rubbed shoulders with Bob Dylan in those days. So Bob Dylan had invited them on to sing a song that he wrote, kind of inspired by them, I guess, called The Hour That the Ship Comes In. So it was all very exciting. We went down to Madison Square Garden in New York with backstage passes, and anyone and everyone was there from the music world, you know. The Clancy brothers then at that time, I think they were lining up, sort of. There was near time for them to go on, I think, before Sinead went out. And
Sinead was introduced by Kris Kristofferson. I'll just play that in, just to bring people right into the room, if you like.
She was
dressed in a pale blue. It looked like it nearly looked like a work outfit. Looked something like
I'm sure that was deliberate, knowing her. There was probably some
of course.
I would imagine
something like Hillary Clinton had wear. It was, and she was there, and she looked very young, and she looked she had the shaved head, and
that's right.
So this is the introduction, then.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sinead O'Connor.
And that continued and continued, and she stood there. She
heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was loud. It wasn't just a couple of people booing, you know. It was quite loud and prolonged and, you know, just so, so disappointing. And you're standing there thinking, what is she going to do? How is she going to, what can she do in a case like this, you know? I was actually quite disappointed that Dylan didn't come out on stage to her defence, in actual fact, and tell the crowd to let her sing, you know. But I don't know what, you know, I guess he had his reasons in Shkelela, but, you know, it was just disappointing.
Yes.
And you felt for her. She just looked in that moment very fragile, actually.
She did, but then, you know, then, like
she
her
responded.
Fearlessness and her courage, like it was...
Yes.
It was superhuman, superhuman.
Absolutely.
And you could see her taking it all in, soaking it all up, and then channeling it.
And she refused to leave the stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. She didn't, because Kris Kristofferson came back out. I think there was an interview this morning. I can't remember what he said to her, but...
Don't mind the bees, he said. Don't mind the bees.
Yeah, I think that was it. Yeah, yes, something to that effect. And I think he kind of invited her, what do you want to do? But no, she held her ground, you know. I think anyone else at that point would have left the stage. But she responded in a way that I guess only Sinead could. You know, she started to quote the lines from the Bob Marley song War, which was completely appropriate.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Okay, turn this up. Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another. regard to race, I say war. And until the ignoble and unhappy regime which holds all of us through child abuse, yeah, child abuse, yeah, subhuman bondage has been toppled, utterly destroyed. Everywhere is war.
Wow.
Wow. And oh, how courageous. But you know what's actually heartwarming there is that you can hear whistles amongst the crowd as well.
Yes.
That, you know, the booing had thought you could hear people in support there for her.
I don't think they're really Bob Dylan fans if they were booing. Anyway,
you can't but be disappointed that he didn't come to her defense. But anyway,
what happened next?
Well, she fled the stage thereafter, I guess. Well, she didn't play. She left the stage, let's say, thereafter. But she actually fled into the arms of my father, Bobby. Just happened to be standing in the wings. And, you know, to be quite honest with you, Ray, he's of another generation. He wouldn't fully have comprehended what was going on. Mm. I think he just thought, you know, the crowd just, she didn't get a good reaction, maybe, to whatever she wanted to perform. I mean, obviously, he was fully aware of who Sinead O'Connor was. But, you know, she fled into his arms and he put his arms around her and he consoled her. And my sister and I went backstage afterwards and I think she probably had left thereafter because I really wanted to meet her. But, I mean, it just the circumstances, you know, it wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. But when we asked my father, you know, what happened? Or he said, oh, you know, I didn't know what was going on. This beautiful young singer just flew into my arms and I put my arms around her and I said, don't worry about it, pet. You get good gigs and bad gigs and F the begrudgers is what he said to her, F the begrudgers, you know? So he didn't quite comprehend kind of the whole background to it, but maybe that was the right thing to say under the circumstances.
Well, thanks for giving us a first-hand account of what happened on that night in 1992.
Yes.
And it just shows, just in those few minutes, the strength and the fearlessness that Sinead O'Connor possessed. If only I could possess a fraction of it. We will talk again, Róisín. Thanks
absolutely.
So much. Thank you. Mind yourself.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Shobsy.
Hello.
You were listening to that.
Yeah. Never heard that, actually.
Did you not?
So I watched the SNL performance yesterday, the second I heard the news, but I'd never heard, like, come on, like that is like, I can't even comprehend it.
Yeah, superhuman, as I was saying. Mm. Thanks so much for coming in. Who'd you bring with you?
This is Adam, my best friend here from Soda Blonde. Yeah. He's going to accompany me here on this tune.
Yeah, and music was just what she was about. There was all that stuff as well, but musically there was nobody on the same level really as Sinead O'Connor when it came to music.
No, she's just like, was an interpreter of the highest level, you know. It's nothing compares to you, not being her song in terms of what she wrote. It is her song, you know what I mean?
And you're going to sing it for us now.
Well, I'm going to try.
In memory of the late Sinead O'Connor, Chobsy, Nothing Compares to You.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. I go out every night and I sleep all day since you took your love away. Since you've been gone, I can do whatever I want. See whomever I choose. I can eat my dinner in a fancy restaurant, but nothing can take away these blues, because nothing compares. Nothing compares to you. Nothing compares to you.
Sinead, rest in peace. Drive Time's on the way.